Thank you, Peter.
Well, I'm Bruce, and thank you for coming. I was just looking around here. I'm definitely the youngest person here, and that says something about the history of polio. I was born in 49, and polio was around, of course, and we had the polio epidemic in Australia in the 50s. Now, I missed a lot of that because I was in New Guinea. I grew up in Papua New Guinea, and that's why my appearance is as it is today. I've got these little skin cancers all over me from the sun, and I'm trying to burn them off with Effudex. Some of you have probably tried that yourself. It's one of these anti-cancer ointments, and one of the consequences is this terrible flaring forehead you get from the cream. So I apologise for my appearance, but it's hopefully it's therapeutic benefit in the long run. But my experience with polio is quite limited because I'm the generation after you. So I didn't see a lot of it at all, although I knew people who had it when I was a kid, because I grew up partly in Papua New Guinea, partly in Australia. My next exposure to polio, I went to work in Prince Henry Hospital in Sydney in the 1970s. I was a first-year medical student, and I found some part-time work there, and I was working in the operating theatres. And stacked down the end of the intensive care unit were the iron lungs. I had never seen them before. And there's great big white things down there, and the curase ventilators and all these sort of things. And of course, Prince Henry Hospital was the infectious disease hospital for the whole of New South Wales in the 1940s and 50s. So all the old equipment was still there. And we also maintained the ventilators for post-polio survivors who needed artificial ventilation still. I don't know if they still have them or not, but these patients had things they put around their waist, and it goes to a pump, and it used to suck out the... so they could breathe. And these were designed... They were designed to fit into cars, so they could drive around Sydney with these 12-volt operated pumps operating these little aspiration ventilators to assist their breathing. They weren't totally dependent on it, but they were partially dependent on assistive ventilation. So part of my job was to maintain these things, and because they had to come in for servicing and fixing up every now and then. So that was my exposure to polio, and since then I haven't seen very much at all or anything to do with polio. It just represents the generation change, polio and the vaccines. We've changed it. I, of course, had all the packs of the Salk and then the Sabin and all that. We just did it because we were kids and told to have it, you know. But so there's this generation difference, and it's very easy to see that here today. When Edith asked me to talk about it, I said, it's not that common. We see patients coming forward for surgery who have post-polio syndrome. But having said that, I've seen one in the last year come to me at Southern Cross for anaesthetic, and that person was very well informed and filled me in on all the details. Prior to that, Edith had filled me in too, by coincidence. And of course, there's a lot on the internet about it too. So I read it all up. But it was a very interesting exposure. But just to put it in some perspective, there's about 4,000 survivors in New Zealand, I think. That's what your literature says. It's about 4,000 of you in New Zealand. We do about 400,000 anaesthetics a year in New Zealand. And that will give you the idea that you're 1 in 1,000. So you really are a minority. And that has a disadvantage in that we don't see a lot of you. I suspect because you're getting older, the proportion of you coming through is getting bigger. Because you're getting older, you're getting all the effects of arthritis, early arthritis, as your literature says, you know, got early arthritis coming on, all the other coincidental illnesses are starting to come through. So we probably see a bit more. Still, you're a very small percentage, 1 in 1,000 at the most, maybe 2. So we do about 300 or 400 anaesthetics a year per person, plus or minus, depending on what we do. So we would see one on average then about 3 or 4 yearly. So it's fairly rare to see you from our point of view. So that's to give you some way of perspective of how common it is from our point of view. Now, we'd probably see more of you in public hospital setting than private hospital setting, because two reasons for that. One is the coincidental illnesses that you have, and two, your age, and because the private sector with its health insurance would mitigate against you because you've got this pre-existing illnesses. You probably know more about this than I do. You probably can't get insurance. I don't know. I would have thought if you tried to get insurance and you were post-polio survivor, they'd say bye-bye. Well, the premium would be ridiculously high. So that pushes you into the public hospital sector. So we'd probably see more of you there than you would say in the private sector. So this is just a few sidelines. I thought I'd go through a little bit about physiology, how we see it from the anaesthetic point of view, and then try and relate it to how it affects to the post-polio syndrome. I borrowed this from my son, 8-year-old son. Had to fight for it. His pad. But I thought I'd just draw how we see you. That's your brain. I'll sort of swing it around so you can look at it. That represents your brain. And on the front of the brain, that's the front, is where your thinking and reasoning, all that kind of thing is. And you're probably familiar with that. And around here, around the back side and back part of your brain, is where all your sensory experiences are, inverted commas, felt. Okay, you've got hearing, you've got vision at the back, you've got hearing around the side, and you've got all the others. There's a big strip down the middle here, and there's a motor strip, an anterior strip, so forth, okay? But inside the middle of the brain, in there, there's an area called the hypothalamus, and other parts got other names that deal with your emotions as well, okay? Then, come down here, you've got what's called the brainstem. And that's, from our point of view, is divided into three parts. Up here, you've got the midbrain, the pons, and the medulla oblongata. Now, they're important from our point of view because they handle all the automatic functions of your body, or autonomic functions, if you like. Your sweating, your heart rate, your breathing regulation, heart regulation, gut regulation. It handles that. So it's quite an important area. The other function that this area has, it's also responsible for the degree of awareness you have. So if you're asleep, this area is quiet. If you're awake, it's active. This is very simplified, you understand, because eye radiation is going up here and all sorts of things, much more complicated than this. But this is simplified just so I can relate to you. So the three parts here, this midbrain area, this brainstem area, is responsible for all those autonomic functions, vascular tone, heart rate, all those sort of things, which are very important because this, when we come back to anesthesia, I'll relate back to again. Down here's the spinal cord with the nerves coming off. Now, there's three parts of the spinal cord from our point of view. There's the area to do with all your somatic functions, that is, your muscle movements, how you move and that kind of thing. Okay? Then there's an autonomic side, which comes down like this. And there's the sympathetic system and the parasympathetic system. And they are linked to the brainstem here and the spinal cord. And they're the nerves that go to the vessels that determine how much tone is in your vessels, how much your gut's working, how much your lung is doing its job and so forth. So there's three sort of components to the spinal cord. There's one to do with your muscular function. There's the ones that handle vessel tone, gut tone. And there's another one that handles sensory from all the senses in your body, such as skin, bones, joints, they all come up the spinal cord and go up there. If I do a cross-section of the spinal cord, it looks like that. Looks like it's sort of double horn like that. If that's the front, and that's the back, you've got the anterior horn cell, which you're familiar with. You know all about the anterior horn cell more than anybody else, more than I do, because that's where traditionally the poliovirus struck, and that's why you've got the paralysis and so forth. But the poliovirus struck more than there, as you know. The poliovirus struck not only the anterior horn cell, but also anywhere where there was any efferent activity. By efferent, I mean outgoing activity. So in the case of muscle, anterior horn cell, that's fairly well known to you, but the autonomic system, which was located here in the brainstem, was also affected. Okay? So that, because this makes outgoing signals, say, to the heart, or to the vessels, or to the gut, the lung, and says, do this, do that, okay, in response to something else. If that's damaged in any way, you don't get quite the same response. And so, as you know, a lot of people, and post-polio people can get what we call orthostatic hypotension. You stand up suddenly and you can collapse, okay, fainting type of attacks, that sort of thing. That's located all in here. Down here is the cerebellum. And that's to do with the coordination of your muscular activities. So when you get up to walk, message goes from the brain down to the cerebellum, says, hey, this person's going to walk, bring the pattern up for walking, brings up a pattern, tells the cerebellum, we're going to walk, and it sends messages down to all the muscles and gets you going. And it's a coordinator of all your muscular function. So from our point of view, we see the body as a brain, with the intellectual components at the front, the sensory, all the rest around the back being sensory and motor. There's a little motor strip, but the rest of it is largely sensory. A midbrain, or a brain stem rather, with three parts, which handle all those autonomic functions of the body, and a spinal cord. Now, when you get older, the whole thing, as you know, starts to slow down. As a rough sort of figure, over the age of 30, in a person who's normally fit and physiologically healthy, they will lose 1% per year of their function. So by the time you're 60, and I'm not that far away from that, my heart function, my respiratory function, and my nervous function is about 30% less than what it was when I was 30. So I'm only running on 2 out of 3 pistons, if you like, okay? I'm 2/3 what I was when I was 30. But on top of that, you have to add disease processes that start hitting after 30. So particular functions may actually be losing at a faster rate than that. For example, cardiac's the commonest one. A lot of people by 60, their cardiac function may be half of what it was when they were 30, particularly if they've had a heart attack, or they've got angina, or they've got blood pressure problems, or something like that, okay? So by the time they get to 60, their reserve, from the anesthetic point of view, is getting less and less and less and less. In the case of polio, and I think there was a good article you gave to me about polio, the rule of twos is quite a good way of looking at it, which means that the rate of loss of function is twice as fast as the normal person, okay? So your cardiac function is probably down to, by the time you're 60, if you have polio when you're in your, say, teens, instead of down to 2/3 of what it was, it may be down to a half. But particularly your nervous function is down lower than that, particularly the functions of this brainstem area, which deal with the automatic parts of the body function, such as heart, lungs, swallowing, breathing. All those kind of autonomic functions are down lower than it would be if you hadn't had polio. That's apart from the effects on your musculature, all those, and the skeletal effects of the polio as well. Okay? So, in a way, in a bland sort of way, we would say, so if you're 60, we say, well, his biological age is probably about 80. Oh, okay? Yeah. So, that's what we might say in our mind. So, we tend to think in reserves. How much reserve have you got left? So if you've got a normal person who's 95 and they come into hospital with a fractured neck or femur and they need surgery, we know, 95, they're hanging in by a thread. They've got very little reserve. So similarly, people who have concurrent disease, and postpartum is one of them, we treat you, or we're encouraged to treat you as though you're a little bit older than you really are, in terms of the drugs in particular that we give to you. All right? Because the rule of two is quite a good one. So that's the effect of your disease process on how this part works, and we're very interested in this part of the brain. Any questions at this stage? Have I gone too slow, too fast, too low-powered, too high-powered?
Can you give them less?
I have a question for probably later. It relates to fainting.
Yep.
But I don't want to hold you up.
Yeah, okay.
What did you say, Rose? Do you give them less or more
anesthetic? I'll come to that right now. Okay. I'll come right now. So physiologically, that's how we see our patients and how we see you when you've got a concurrent disease like post-polio or something like this. Okay?
So, Bruce, if we went into the theatre and you had a chart with us and it said post-polio on the chart, if somebody like yourself, not you particularly because you're knowledgeable, but somebody different than you, might be 30 or 35 or 40, he would think like you?
No. No, the modern generation of anaesthetists don't see... It's very interesting how quick things change. We've got through a generation of anaesthetists now who are in the training ones, the registrars. They're like 20, mid-20. They haven't heard of a lot of things that you heard, just like I didn't have a lot of... I was the tail end of the infectious era, if you like. You're talking about that they've never seen polio. They've read about it. It's not even examined, probably, because they just don't see it. So they wouldn't probably anything at all.
So if they read the chart, they wouldn't say, okay, they're 60 means. Years age, we've got to think of them as 80 years of age because they've got these additional problems of post-polio.
They may do. The chances are they would probably not. Mm-hmm. So you need to... That's where you come in, where you need... We need you to educate us.
But if we come in and we're half-sozzled anyway and funny... Oh, I have polio, you know. I mean, how are we going to communicate that? Do we have? How do we go? What's the procedure, the protocol?
if you're half sozzle, that's a bit difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's too late to leave it then.
Yeah,
say,
it is a bit, yeah.
What about those alert cards that we've got?
So we say, we hold up the alert card after we've had... been shaved and all prepped and everything for whatever we're going to have.
You've got to tell them.
We do have to. There must be some protocol set in place, though, that's beyond just holding up a card.
I doubt that the hospital have a protocol for post-polio. I doubt it.
I don't think they have.
I doubt it.
The young doctors recognise what polio is.
No, they don't.
No, they don't.
You know, the alarm bells don't go in there because they say polio.
It's gone.
They really don't know the gravity of the disease.
In today, for example, we're not in the era of infectious disease, except for AIDS. Mm. All right, everybody knows about AIDS, but the community at large doesn't know about infectious disease. And in the medical schools, the word polio will be mentioned in part of their course, but that's probably as far as we'll go. See, smallpox is said to be eradicated, you know, and that's what they want us to believe, though. And so that's probably the limit of the exposure that the modern medical people get. Now, in our training in anaesthetists, we would probably read about post-polio syndrome, but that would be it, because it's one in a thousand.
I had an experience of going to the hospital, I'll say this quickly, just a few months ago, into the Waikato hospital, and I kept explaining to them I'd had a fall, what my situation was, and I kept telling them I was post-polio, but they could not understand or take it in at all, because I was sitting in the bed, just like you would be, had no idea whatsoever.
Mm. So, particularly with like post-polio and a few other conditions, when you're like you are now, that doesn't give a good indication of what reserve you've got. In fact, you've got very little reserve. Whereas, sorry, I can't remember your name. If I saw you and you didn't tell me, I would treat you as though you are your age and you are a normal, fit, health, physiological person for that age. But in fact, your reserve is lower if you've had polio. Okay? But I wouldn't know by just looking at you. And if I did fancy tests, they may pick it up, they may not. Particularly the autonomic bit, those automatic functions, they won't pick up unless you do special tests. There are very special tests, but there's no trigger for me to ask for those tests. Okay?
He just told us that he's getting weaker all the time. He's having trouble now holding things, so he knows what's happening to him.
Mm.
He has to get it over to the doctor. Yeah. Fortunately, we've got our doctor believes in post-polio syndrome. And he puts in reports that I've got post-polio syndrome. I don't know whether the other sort of specialists take much notice, but yes, so just a matter of...
But in general, I would have thought the medical and nursing professions would not ring any bells.
Yeah. Right.
Can you see, Bruce, that this makes us feel quite vulnerable?
Oh, you are.
And why we need to have the information you can give us today? Because, see, if we... are involved in a crisis or an emergency, and we don't have our husband or one of our family, you know, like my daughter or somebody with us who can explain on our behalf. Say we were knocked unconscious, or whatever happened. You know, we're very vulnerable, and we don't want to scare each other with the horror stories. But this is why we don't know what to do.
Well, one of the things about the bracelets. And there's pluses and minuses to the bracelets. The problem with the bracelets you can get, the medical alert, is a lot of people wear them for things they shouldn't. And so people become a bit blasé about them. It's lost its value to a large degree about, you know, what it means. I mean, a lot of them will have, for example, diabetes on medication. Now, that's okay, but then you get somebody who really needs it, and we tend to treat it a bit flippantly because there's so many people wearing these things. Yeah. I wonder if it would be worthwhile for you have your own bracelet.
Well, that's what Barbara was saying. It's not a bracelet. It's actually a little alert card.
Or card.
It lists things like anti-inflammatory and other things that we shouldn't, medications, gives them by name. But I mean, if you're knocked out or you're bleeding to death or something, who's going to look through your handbag? They wouldn't know to look through your handbag and find it.
Thanks.
So many years ago, with the patient's notes, if they were allergic, especially to antibiotics,
nice big red sticker was put on the top of their file because you couldn't miss it.
Mm.
I don't know if they still do that these days, though.
There is a system that I worked in the hospital, but it's dependent on the patient telling them. And an alert is put up, it's also on the computer system.
Yep.
But it still doesn't explain very much. It doesn't give much scope for a lot of explanation.
Was it last year with the disability show that we had down there? I had a bunch of four nurses come up when I was sitting on there. They didn't even know what polio was. They didn't know what happened to people. And they didn't know anything about the after effects.
My husband look after her child, my grandchild. And my son said to her that he was worried that I wouldn't be able to cope, and she just turned around and said, "Well, how old do you think your mother is? You know, there's just no because you look okay. There's no sort of think. Well, I might have trouble lifting her, changing nappies."
So the medical course reflects where the community is, and the community is not an infectious disease. Out of that, it's gone beyond that. I remember talking about medical school, you know, they're saying infectious disease will be a thing of the past within so many years, you know, just 30 years ago. It's still here, but in a different form. I'll go back to anaesthesia, and this is the bit you're probably more interested in. Now, I'll just define general anaesthesia for you, and I'll go on about anaesthesia in a bit wider. General anaesthesia, or anaesthesia, is a state where we put you and we control certain reflexes. That's that midbrain I was talking about. This is where all the reflexes go through, except for the muscular reflexes. You know, if you trip on something or you tread on something, you try to move your toe, that's a reflex which goes through the spinal cord, and for that you've got to have a good circuit, okay, going from some sort of sensor up your leg, the nerve up your leg, through the spinal cord and out through the anterior horn, through the motor nerve. If the motor nerve is shot, then of course you don't get the reflex. So that we've got to control that reflex for the surgeons. The surgeons just don't want you to move. Okay, they don't care if you're awake, sleep, whatever. Surgeons just do not want you to move. All right? But there are other reflexes. They are the autonomic ones which I referred to earlier, coming through the midbrain or brainstem area. That's to do with your heart rate, your blood pressure, your breathing, your gut motility, all those sort of things which you don't have any conscious awareness of, but which are very vital to keeping you alive. The other part of that is keeping you asleep so that you also don't feel the surgery, but at the same time, we don't overdose you, okay? That's general anaesthesia. So the reflexes we control when you're asleep are, one, your muscular reflexes, so you don't move. Two is the sympathetic one, which is to do with heart rate, blood pressure. We've got to control that. There's another one, which is to do with hormones that come particularly from the adrenal gland. That's linked to what we call the sympathetic system, and it's producing noradrenaline, adrenaline, all these sort of hormones that control your vascular tone, blood pressure as well, flow to the kidney, all that kind of thing. We're interested in that as well. And we're also interested in what happens locally, because when you cut yourself or you stand on your toe, you notice you get a red flaring, you get swelling, all that kind of thing, all the local sort of inflammatory things. That's a reflex, and we're interested in controlling that too, because that has to do with pain, because we're interested in pain. As anaesthetists, very interested in pain. So there's those four reflexes, okay? The muscle reflexes, the autonomic ones, the blood pressure, heart rate, gut, all that kind of thing, blood flow, which we're really interested in, and the hormones, which interlink with that, and the fourth one is the local one. Now, when we put you to sleep, I won't go through the mechanics, put a drip in and so forth, that's not what we're talking about, but the drugs we give to you as a patient are, generally speaking, we look at you and we say, yeah, he's male. We often do this unconsciously, okay? Male, he's 60 kilograms in weight. He's physiologically pretty good. He tells me he's got no heart disease. He's got none of this, none of that. Okay, so he's pretty normal sort of specimen. So I'll give him the normal dosages on a per kilogram basis. Now, we tend to rate humans in four groups. You've got adult men, adult women, pregnant women, because they're different species. Okay, they are very different. Pregnant woman and a non-pregnant woman, two different animals. Yeah, very much so. And then you've got kids, and kids are divided into three. Neonates, which are very different from toddlers, which are very different from, say, kids 8, 9, 10, 11. Okay? So we unconsciously, and when we're training consciously, categorise you into one of these areas, female, pregnant, non-pregnant. And then you add on to that all the things they've told you. Yes, I've got high blood pressure. Yes, I've had this. Yes, we've had operations for this. Yes. And the more they tell us, then we look at the list of medications. We say, right, the reserve's getting less and less and less and less and less and less. Okay, you've got the idea? So that's what we do. So you guys, when you come in, we say, right, we've got, say you, sorry, what's your name?
Paul,
how old are you, Paul?
He's the baby
here. Yeah. How old, Paul?
About 54.
Paul's 54, so Paul would come for surgery. Now, I see straight away he's in a wheelchair. He's 54, he's about my age. And then I'd say to Paul, what, apart from your post polio, because you're here, I know you've got post polio, but what are the effects of post polio on you? And you would tell me that. But don't forget, most of the nieces won't know what it is. The older nieces do. For example, most of you might know Hugh Clarkson in this town, and he's just around for many, many years. He does because he was around. Okay? And then I'd go ask you about, do you have heart disease, chest disease, any other diseases? What medications you want? And I'll sort it out. And I say, right, and the operation he's going to have is this, therefore I work out which sort of anaesthesia is the best that I think for him. Now, anaesthesia, we divide it up in our minds. We've got general anaesthesia and regional anaesthesia. General anaesthesia and regional. Oh, too hard to draw. I'll just talk about regional to sort of... regional anaesthesia is when we numb a part of your body. And it could be a spinal anaesthetic, which is where you put a small needle into the cerebrospinal fluid, okay, and you go numb. Now, some of you might have already had that for some reason or other. Yeah. Hip replacements, knee replacements, prosthetic surgery.
That's a local anaesthetic?
It's a local anaesthetic. Okay. And we put local anaesthetic into the CSF fluid, cerebrospinal fluid, and you go numb from there down. All right. The other form is epidural, which is similar but not quite the same. But the effect is more or less the same. But it takes longer to work and a few other things about it. But it's in the back of it, put in the back, just the same. Okay, but it doesn't go into the fluid surrounding the spinal cord. That's the difference between the two. We use a lot for labour delivery suites, okay, and we use it sometimes for general surgery as well. Other forms of regional anaesthesia are like blocking off an arm, local anaesthetic into here, blocking off fingers, local anaesthetic into here. Okay. Sometimes we use it for blocks in the eyes. If you had cataracts done, they sometimes do that too, put a block behind the eye. Yeah. Okay. They're local anaesthetic blocks. General anaesthesia has two parts to it. One is when we paralyse you, and the other one is when we don't. All right. Now, this is quite important when it comes to you guys. Because, if I can sort of, do you all know what an axon is?
No.
Right, I'll tell you. That's a nerve cell, sort of. And down here, there's all these little branches. Okay, this cell might be coming from the spinal cord. This might be your anterior horn cell, for example, okay? That's your motor neuron, which you do know about. Okay, you know all about motor neurons. That might be a motor neuron. Say that's coming from a spinal cord, which is here. The cell body, which is actually in the spinal cord, actually, comes down here. That's the axon. Then it breaks up into these little dendrites, down like this. You've got a muscle here, down here. Now, between that ending there is a very special area. You all drink champagne? No champagne? Well, you know, champagne bubbles when you take the top off. Well, that's what's down here, little bubbles in there. They're called vesicles, millions of them, millions and millions. And they contain the neurotransmitter substance. So when the nerve stimulus comes down here, goes down here, these things are released and go across the little gap between the nerve ending and the muscle, a special part of the muscle. These little packets of neuromuscular transmitter go across there, and then they trigger the muscle to contract. Okay, so that's how it works. Incidentally, that's the same as what happens in your brain, except instead of a muscle, it's more nerves. Okay, it's more nerves which add up and subtract and so forth. But in the case of the muscle, these nerves go across here and it contracts. In polio, some of these anterior horn cells, as you know, are destroyed or damaged. And so all this dies off. The ones that survive may actually develop more dendrites. Okay? Or some cells may recover or partially recover. So those cells that remain have big demands on the cell body up here because they're working harder than in the normal person to produce the muscular activity that you guys need. Got the idea? Haven't lost you? Have I lost anybody? So now we've got more dendrites to come down here, okay? So we've got more little vesicles being produced by a smaller number of cells that's left in the spinal cord or up in the brainstem or up further, wherever you've got something that involves movement, whether it be smooth muscle or ordinary muscle. Got the idea? All right. So this substance goes across here is the stuff we block when we give you a muscle-relaxing anesthetic. Drugs like succinylcholinium, alkylcholinium, which probably don't mean much to you, but you remember the old stories of the South American Indians with the blowpipes? You all read those stories from childhood. They poisoned animals and animals died. They died because they had paralyzing agent in it called curare. And all the modern agents we have for paralyzing you are synthetic versions of that, with better properties, but they're a type of curare, where they inject it into you, just like the South American blowpipe, and you lie there awake, paralyzed. You can't breathe. And then you slowly die as you become hypoxic and as your CO2 rises, okay? So any of you who've had the polio and have been in the... Anybody been in the old ventilators, the Curace ventilators or the iron lungs? Does anybody remember that? They said that before they got into that, that's what it felt like. You know, you couldn't breathe and, of course, it eventually became hypoxic. So that our muscle reactants work here. Now, in the case of you guys, as you start getting older and older and older, these cells get tired and some die, as occurs in the normal individual. The only trouble is when they do, they take out a bigger chunk compared to the normal person. So therefore, you get increasing muscle weakness, okay, as you get older, faster than it is in my case or somebody who hasn't had polio. Now, that tells me that, okay, you've got less of these around in your neuromuscular junctions, we call it, so I need a lot less relaxant. If I'm going to paralyze you, and we do have to paralyze you for certain operations on your abdomen, on your chest in particular, or neurosurgery, then we do have to paralyze you. Okay, you've got no way around that to produce a safe operating field for whatever that surgeon's going to do. But if I gave you the normal muscle relaxant dose that I would normally give, then of course it's going to take a longer time. And that's why people have been caught out. They've been paralyzed and they wouldn't reverse, what we call reverse. They can wake up, but they can't breathe, they can't move. And I'm sure some people here might have experienced that. You had anesthetic, and when you wake up, you can wake, but you can't move. And it's a horrible feeling, really horrible, because you're short on these things and we've overdosed you relatively. Got the idea? Okay. So that's a particular significance to us anaesthetists. The other sort of anaesthetic is where we put you to sleep and you breathe on your own spontaneously. That's fine to a point. If you do that on a normal individual, they'll breathe away with the agents we give you, but you watch them getting slower and slower. Now, in the case of post-polio syndrome, you'll see that the carbon dioxide levels rise much higher than they do in the normal individual, even though you haven't necessarily been ventilated when you were younger, when you had the polio, or you had some sort of respiratory deficiency when you had the polio. A lot of polio sufferers have it subclinically. Now, you can check for it on certain respiratory function tests, but normally we wouldn't do that unless there's a special reason to do it. We would know, well, I know now, that you, even though you haven't had it clinically, there is reduced reserve. So that would say to me, well, if it's a long operation, normally I could do this, get the patient to breathe on their own. I wouldn't try it with you because the carbon dioxide might go too high and the oxygen may come down too low. So I wouldn't try it. So the message is that you've got to tell an anaesthetist, hey, I've got post-polio syndrome and that I need less of everything, all the drugs that we normally give to you guys. Okay? Now, if I gave you... The typical sort of anaesthetic would be I'll give you a drug like Valium. It's midazolam, but it's the same class as Valium. And that's on your card, I think, that Valium. Well, it's benzodiazepine group in your card there. That's the same thing. Midazolam is a benzodiazepine, just like Valium.
And that's okay or not for us?
Well, I'll come to that. Yes, it is, but in a reduced dose. I'll give you midazolam. It's an anxiolytic drug, so it reduces the anxiety of you coming for surgery. But also, a lot of our drugs interact in various ways. So I'll give you midazolam, then I'll give you a drug called fentanyl. Now, both of these affect your respiratory system through the midbrain or brainstem area. Post-polio, you'd probably go to sleep on a milligram, whereas most people wouldn't go to sleep on two. Okay? If I gave you fentanyl, which is a narcotic analgesic, short-acting, very potent, it may even cause you to stop breathing, whereas an average person it wouldn't. They just might slow down. So that's a normal sequence, midazolam, fentanyl. Then we put you to sleep with an induction agent. Now, induction agent, everybody's heard of thiopentone? Pentothal from World War II? Pentothal's been around a long time. It's now gone. It's been replaced by much more modern drugs, but they all do the same thing. They make you slow your breathing down. Again, a lot less dose is required in your cells. Post-polio compared to giving to an adult, I know you'll stop. A lot of cases doesn't matter because then I'll paralyse you. But again, if I want you to wake up whenever the operation's finished, I want to be able to reverse that relaxant. And as I've said, you've already got a reduced number and probably quality as well, so I've got to give you less. So the message for us anaesthetists, from you people, is that we give you less of most things. Now, the other thing we're interested in is pain relief. Now, the study of pain has come a long way in the last 10, 15 years with the International Association for the Study of Pain. And there's now pain clinics all over the country. There's specialist pain meetings. It's big time now. And we've got a lot of understanding about pain. But polio people, post-polio people, and like a lot of people in our community for other reasons, and you're one of that group, have increased sensitivity to pain. Okay, not all of you. Some of you, maybe 20%. But that's higher than the average population. Okay, have this increased sensitivity to pain. And also, because of the effect on the brainstem where your temperature control is located, your temperature goes up and down. It's not as well regulated as the normal person. So in the theatre, where everybody gets cold, and we do our best to stop that, that's one of the things I hate about when I go as a patient to have surgery. I say, I don't care what you do, just keep me warm. I can't stand being cold. And post-polio, as well as a lot of the other neurological type cases where their temperature regulation is affected, drop off their temperature very quickly, very quickly. And that interferes with the way our drugs work. That's one important issue. They act longer in general. They tend to act longer. Okay? So we've got to keep yourselves warm. A bit of a laugh in theatre. When I go into theatre, I go rugged up. And people laugh at me and they say, what's jolly cold? I go long johns everywhere. I'm so cold. Even outside here. But in the theatre, I said, if the patient's cold and I'm cold, you know, it's really important because I feel the cold. And if I'm cold, that patient's cold. Now, we do measure your temperature, actually, in theatre. We do measure it. And it tells us only part of the story. But nonetheless, you do get cold very, very quickly. And we do our best to combat that.
Lewis, could I just put something right in here? Mm. I don't know if it's relevant. But when you have a blood transfusion and the blood is cold, for a post-polio person to actually heat that blood as it's going into them, to warm it up to their body temperature, it takes a huge amount of energy to do that our body. And I don't know how, even just a saline drip, if it's cold, coming into a body that takes a lot of energy.
Yep. That's been well documented.
I don't know how that is solved, because I had a saline drip in about less than a year ago and I was absolutely exhausted at the end of it. I was totally wiped out, and I thought, she suggested it's just a drip. What are you laying there going like this?
Well, you can work it out. There's been a lot of study done on this, and that's why we have blood warmers. We use blood warmers pretty well routinely in operating theatres. For normal saline, we wouldn't normally use it. But blood, because it comes to us at about 4-6 degrees, something like that, it's very cold, and you can work it out. Your body weight, say you're 50 kilogram, and that thing's 500, or say it's a litre for convenience, you can work out what it does. It drops the temperature all right. Mm. And ask for a blood warmer.
Oh, okay.
But they, we use them frequently, all the time for major surgery.
Because we, to warm, to keep warm, it takes a tremendous amount of energy for us to do that. Like most of us, I mean, I don't know, I'm speaking for not everybody, but to get into a cold swimming pool is no, you can't do it. You have to get into a warm swimming pool. I don't swim in cold water anymore because the energy to keep warm is too great. It's exhausting.
That applies to me. I haven't got postpartum, but I cannot swim in cold water. So I just freeze up.
What do we do about that when you have, when you have a blood transfusion?
Ask for a blood warmer. We do have them. They're routinely available. We use them routinely for major surgery.
Yeah, it would. I don't know if anyone's felt it, but you just go into a very fine fibrillating. You just sort of
shake.
Jittering.
Yep.
It's going in, and my husband, I kept saying, I need a blanket. I still couldn't get warm. Blankets don't keep you warm.
Not if you're cold to start with. The other thing is some of the agents we use, particularly inhalation agents. Now, ether's gone. Anybody remember ether? No. Good stuff, eh?
You're not going to get it warmer. You're not going to get it anymore.
It's gone.
Long time since I had enough.
Yeah, it's gone. But it was replaced by agents that tend to cause shaking in some people. And even the most modern agent, which is called desflurane, it will tend to make some people shake, particularly if they've got some sort of nervous or disease, like post-polio syndrome is one of them, MS is another, all these neurological type disorders, they are less able to compensate with the effect of the inhalation agent on the muscle and the nerve, because these agents work on both, okay? So that they shake. So if you're already cold, then you've got this on top of it. I have seen, when I was at Prince Henry Hospital, I remember so clearly seeing a patient going from the theatre to intensive care. He was shaking so much he was moving a foot off the bed, and the bed, you could hear it rattling 100 yards down the hall. It's so extreme. Now, modern agents aren't quite as bad as that, but nonetheless, it can happen. And we've got to keep you warm as well. The shaking uses a lot more energy than just being cold.
And is that dangerous?
Yes, it is. It is.
Hmm? How do you get your legs warm? It takes me about 3 hours at night when I go to bed until my legs are warm.
I'll ask the experts.
Go to bed earlier.
There. Just on that point, the issue of your cold feet may not be related to post polio. It could well be other things. I mean, I don't know if you're diabetic. Diabetes does it. It could be vascular. Could be vascular disease. Okay, as you get older, your plumbing starts clogging up, and that's the commonest cause of cold feet in your age group is clogged up plumbing.
Clogged up plumbing.
Yeah.
How do I unclog it?
Well, you need to see your doctor about that. But your vessels up here, particularly up here, start getting clogged up with atheroma, just like your heart ones do, just like the aorta. They all clog up with age. It's part of the aging process. But that's the commonest. But also the small vessels down here start getting less. They have less ability to go like this, vasodilate and vasoconstrict, and that's the commonest cause. So it may not be post-polio, important point. Okay, it could be something else. So don't put it down to polio, it may not be. Okay, because you're getting into that age where there's a lot of other things beginning to happen in your body.
Could be something else.
Yeah, could well be. Now, I was just going to say that until very recently, we haven't been able to titrate our anaesthetics to you as an individual. We've sort of had to think, put you in a category, okay? Dick, is it? Dick? I said to Dick, okay, how old I think he is, he's in that category, and I'd give him the anaesthesia for that category. Monitoring as I go along, because we do an awful lot of monitoring today, heart rate, blood pressure, ECG, oxygen, carbon dioxide, inhalation agent, and a whole lot of others, muscle, how much paralysed you are, and all sort of thing. And that's individualised. And we have to adjust it as we go along. But we're getting much better at being able to individualise our anaesthetics. We now have things like this. I'll go through all the stuff that you've given to me. We now have things like this, which are becoming available, generally available, which we put electrodes on your head, and it measures a modified EEG. You know what EEG is? Electroencephalograms. This device, for example, this is called an Apex. Now, what this one does is it makes a click in your ear. The ear goes through the brainstem. Okay, so it goes through the brainstem, and then we measure the result up here, and so we can change the depth of anesthesia to according to what that's telling us. Whereas before, as of now, we don't really have that. We have very indirect measures of where you are in our anesthesia. You know, maybe you're sweating a bit. That maybe tell. Oh, maybe you're a bit light. You know, it's pretty. It's all clinical. But we're getting much better at getting these sort of monitors, which tell us where you are, and we can individualize the anesthesia much better. That's really good for guys like post polio syndrome, or people whose, for whatever reason, their margins of error or their reserves are getting smaller and smaller. And as you get older and older, it gets smaller and smaller. So this really helps us. This is becoming generally available in New Zealand. We've got two units here, I think, but not this one, but one like it at Waikato. Not generally available at Waikato. And Hamilton, they're the only two we've got. There's a few in Auckland. The United States is full of them. One of the big things it does is it prevents us from overdosing you. And that's really important when you've got diminished reserve, such as yourselves with post polio. The other thing we're doing more and more, and we've had this around for a while, and this is a nerve stimulator. When we do that quite frequently already, and this is a later version, it looks a bit black box like that. Sometimes it fits up in a great big monitor. But we put electrodes on here, or anywhere else where there's a nerve, and we stimulate that nerve. This is usually when you sleep, by the way, because when you're awake, it can really hurt. And we see what your fingers do, you know. And if you're paralysed, of course, they don't move. But we can titrate the amount of muscle relaxant we give to you so we get the response we want, so we don't over-paralyse you. Again, good news for those people with diminished reserve. Even amongst the normal population, the degree of variation is enormous. Is enormous. Two people like Dick, and when you get them there, and they're two different species, you know, the degree of variation is enormous. Then on top of that, you've got people such as yourselves, post polio, multiple sclerosis, strokes, and they're a different population again. So we're moving down the pathway where we can actually individualise what we do for your anaesthetic better than we were able to do in the past. Mm-hmm. Bit about local anaesthetics, and then I'll open to questions. Mm-hmm. Local anaesthetics, dental is the commonest. Probably most people go to the dentist. I'm very fortunate. I've never had a tooth out and never had a filling, so I don't know what it's like. No idea. No idea. I can't. Got no personal experience at all to what it's like to have an injection in your mouth and your mouth go numb. I've got no idea. And I don't want to know. I'll keep out of there. But the degree of variation for most people for local anaesthetics in the mouth is very much dependent on the anaesthetist, well, in the case of the dentist does it, dentist's ability and the type of local anaesthetic and the nerve anatomy in that individual. In such as post polio and other nervous syndromes, you can get a wide range. Some people, the whole head will go numb. No, the huge side of the face will go numb, and for a long time. In some patients, it doesn't work at all. There's a group of patients we have in the community called chronic pain patients, and they're an increasing number in our community, and post polio comes into that group. Okay? And certain types of local anaesthetics just do not work. Okay, and you can give as much as you like, it won't work. And in general, those patients need very special handling. But for the majority of people, just this increase in variation of the region that's affected and the duration that it's affected. I've heard lots of stories about small areas being numb to great big areas with the same amount of local. That happens anyway, but with dental it seems to be more variation. So I can't talk about personal experience with that because I've never had it. Mm.
Just before we open up the question, because there are some here that can tell you their experience at the dentist, but just getting back to us going into hospital, say we're admitted to the hospital, and usually before you go to theatre, the anaesthetist comes and sits by your bed?
That's becoming less and less common because in the normal state of affairs, you often don't come in. And if you're elective surgery, until the day of surgery, the first time I get to see most of my patients is in the theatre. Because the system does not allow patients to be seen very early on. Now, we do have a pre-admission clinic in Waikato, which we try to get most patients to get, and that's when it's all sorted out. Yeah. Now, if you can get to that, that's what's important. If you do have to have surgery, that you do make sure you get to a pre-admission clinic.
Can your doctor recommend that when he, you know, like your general GP, can he say this patient needs to consult with the anaesthetist before he goes?
Yeah, with a pre-admission clinic at Waikato Hospital, that's right. Yeah.
So if we do that, what sort of things, you know, do we need to be aware of? Because when you're a little bit uptight or you're in pain or you're sick or you haven't got your head together properly, it's hard to think of what, you know what I mean? You can't think of what the common sense things are to ask.
I think if I was in that situation, I would have a bit of paper which I carried on me which had my personal history on it and my personal the effects of the postbiotic syndrome on me, plus your generic one. Because I know you're all different when it comes to the effects of post-polio. Yeah. So what I assume for Dick won't be what I assume for you.
No, but then we can't... I don't feel comfortable saying I only need a fraction or a third or a half or something of the anaesthetic and then find them down there screaming in pain because you didn't knock me out enough.
What happens is you'll go to pre-admission clinic and they will see you. Then they normally will say it's me. They will normally ring me up.
You. I'm not going if it's not you.
Well, they'll send a message. They contact me the same as saying there's a patient on this list who's so-and-so, who's got this, and then I will take that and either contact directly and or get the notes out from the... That's the first thing, get the notes. Medical records?
Mm. Yeah.
Get the medical record notes?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then contact directly. And sometimes you contact GP too. Because they often have a lot of information that the hospital doesn't have or that the patient doesn't have. And so then information comes together. But even so, I may not see you until the day of surgery. I've only got the information. Now, it's a bit of a pity, really, because just by looking at you, I get 90% of my information, just by looking at you. But, and so we don't get that delayed in the event, through the sequence coming through.
But you can't tell by looking. I mean, I went to have an X-ray, and a young boy, lovely, handsome, darling young boy, lucky if he was 28 years of age or in that age group, and I'm laying on the bed on the X-ray, and I said, now, I've had post-polio, and he looked at me, what's up with her? And I said, I can't lift my legs up, so if you lift them and let go of them, they're just going to crash on the bed, and I've got fractured ankles. But it took him a while until he picked my leg up and tried it, that it wasn't going to hold itself stiff up in the air like this, and he had to be careful with it. And I said to him afterwards, would you have known? And he said, no, not necessarily. He might have thought, well, funny legs, you know, they're thin or the toes are deformed or whatever. There might be a few clues which we have about us that might have put alarm bells in the young man's mind. But he said, I have no idea what post-polio, I don't even know what polio is.
No, he
was an X-ray technician, didn't have any idea how to move a body that had polio, anything like that. What to look for, anything. I mean, he said, get off the bed, walk over there and stand up and do this.
Yes, you know.
I said, you've got to be kidding, I can't walk over there. Well, what shall I do? And I said, I don't know. I don't know how you're going to get me to stand up by that machine over there. It's all right if I'm laying down. And we did find something how to do it. But anyway, I was so mad. And I got in the waiting room and I said to the lady in the waiting room sitting there beside me with her teenage boy, and I said, he's never heard of polio. And she said, what's polio? And I started to say, oh, yes, I know now. And she said to the boy, to her son, who was a teenager, do you know what polio is? And he said, isn't that a sport or something you play, Mum? So three people in that one area, none of them had... And I just thought, what hope have I got here? I was so frustrated. And that's a minor thing, just going to have an X-ray. So, I mean, how are we supposed to communicate to the medical profession in a way? Because I get easily upset, and I don't want to get upset. I want to be able to go in there and calmly and nicely and professionally.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you feel when you go? Do you get upset or angry, or how do you do it?
One of the issues, of course, is there's not just medical profession. There's you'd probably see 20 different professions.
Yeah,
you'd see radiographers, radiologists, you'd see the different receptionists, you'd see the nurses, you'd see the junior medical staff, the registrar's house surgeon, you'd see the senior consultants on the team, whatever that might be, and you'll probably see physios, it could even be OTs, you could be... There's stacks of them.
You're going back to that cast, it's about the only thing we can do, and then half the time they don't read it anyway. And if you get stroppy, you insist...
Yeah.
Then you're able to strop it.
Yeah, and that's what I'm trying to say. I get easily upset, and that's not what you want to do. You want to be in there calm and professional and, you know, be sensible so that they're not going to label you and ignore you, you know, as being a freak. So how we can approach it when we're already anxious to go up to the hospital in the first place. But I tell you, Bruce,
you need
no polio
person,
is going to go up there unless they see you, are we?
you need
Who knows?
Yeah, you really did an advocate. don't you?
Yeah, well, you that's usually our spouse. Yeah.
Beg pardon?
That's usually our spouse.
Yes, yes. Yes, you need to have
your advocate.
Yeah, really. You, well, see, yeah. I mean, that's a possibility.
There is a system of patient advocacy.
Well, there is and there isn't.
There's a leaflet about it anyway.
Yeah, yeah. That's to do with disputes, really.
Okay.
That's to do with disputes about treatment that's gone wrong. But they haven't got into the proactive patient advocate where the patient has somebody who speaks, who's actually looking and coordinating their patient's care. They don't have that. They do in some United States hospitals, which is very strong, works quite well. But no, I mean, from this is a special interest group, so like that's where you need the special advocate. And see, like MS, those sort of groups, they need the similar sort of thing because most of us, as I say, we only see you one in a thousand. And same with the other neurological disorders and other rare things. I saw a patient the other day of which there was three in the world or something. You know, I'd never heard of it. And I had to quickly do a study up on it. But, you know, we do get them, but this is one in several million, you know.
Is there anything we can do for ourselves, such as if you go on focusing on, well, the hospital we're most likely to go to is Waikato.
Mm.
So work on the one hospital. Is there any scope at all for trying to incorporate something in their library system so that there's a resource for them to go to, if only you can trigger them to go to the resource?
Yeah. Perhaps the librarian would be the place to go.
How much of that is online as opposed to a hard copy? They were going to get it transferred over.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff online. There is. For example, we're still behind, of course, on our online access, but it'd be very, very useful. I mean, we can do that now to some extent. We can go on the internet, and I could call up post polio syndrome on the internet, and that's what I would do
right. If
I was in the theatre. And
so that's perhaps what we could do.
Yeah, and put on the intranet. They've got an intranet there.
Time for them to alert them to go to that.
Yeah, so if I got a message saying that you were coming through to theatre on such and such a day for a knee replacement or hip replacement, is what I do. So I would then go to the, I'd go to the internet or the intranet. The intranet has all the policies on it.
Yeah.
And so there might be a policy or a clinical routine or regimen for whatever. For example, there's one for diabetes, for example.
Right.
There's already one for diabetes. And there could be one for post-polio.
Sure.
No reason why I couldn't
do
anything.
Sure. I just came across a disease known as pemphigus. It's one in a million. It's a skin disease.
Yes, yes.
And I went to the internet and I just got the whole details.
Yeah,
it.
It's very accessible on the internet.
It's a good information of post-polio syndrome on the internet.
There is, excellent.
Yeah, daughter managed to get off. She couldn't quite do it, but it was about 3 or 4 pages.
No, it's very accessible. And most hospitals now, Waikato does have limited access in theatres, and it's not there all the time.
I like what you're saying, that perhaps the hospital themselves have their own policy.
They could.
It's a protocol that they follow when they hit post-polio,
yeah.
Right?
Actually, the difficult part from your point of view is when you come into hospital, if the anaesthetist knows you've got post-polio syndrome and he's just upgraded a little bit in his knowledge, the most difficult part from you is not there. It's actually the rest of it. It's when you go back to the wards.
Yes.
Post-op is where the big hassles are for anybody.
Yes.
Anybody.
Fuzzy in the head.
Well, you're fuzzy in the head and they just don't have adequate staff to look after you in a special way that they just don't have it. So that's where the real problems really start,
yeah.
In the ward.
Once again,
in aftercare.
The protocols, that's a case of
yeah,
somebody flicking them to, there's a protocol to follow here.
Yeah, that would allow the charge nurse to pass that on to the carers for that particular patient. Because
yeah.
They do have it, like diabetes has one, for example.
Well, when they have reports, like morning and afternoon reports and things like that, that should be brought up then if they have a post-polio person on the ward. Because those nurses don't know what the hell I was talking about. They didn't have a clue. And I mean, there should be some leaflets or something that's given to them. Read this here and now, okay? Because someone wouldn't bother to go on the internet. They just say, oh yeah.
Most obvious place is to put it in your folder.
Yes.
In your patient folder.
Yeah. We're lucky enough to have private insurance, and we both had operations this last year. And the anaesthetist came and saw us the night before, and I would say she'd spend about 20 minutes to half an hour just having a chat. And she was getting information, I guess, that I didn't realise she was sort of getting information out of us. She just talked away to us, and she knew exactly where we were.
Mm.
So it's expensive. But
one of the things is that we used to have patients come in on the night before surgery. That doesn't happen very often now because it's expensive. And so they often come in the day of surgery. That has some advantages. You don't sit there all night being anxious. Mm. You sit at home being anxious instead. But, yeah.
Well, actually, our time's gone to after 3 now, but I know that you'd like to spend a bit of time with Bruce. Is that all right? Would you stay for afternoon tea?
Yeah, I've got to go in about 15 minutes.
Okay, well, then we won't have afternoon tea till then. But if you've got any specific questions, maybe about dentist or some experience, but let's keep it to the anaesthetic thing, not general post-polio things, otherwise we won't move along. But just using Bruce's knowledge for the few minutes that he's got left, specifically to do with anaesthetic or something that you've experienced that you'd like some clarification about.
What about you, Dick?
Jean, I'm going to ask about the fainting.
Fainting.
It's not in relation to anaesthetic, though.
Well, it is, in the sense that patients the next day,
yes.
the modern anaesthetic agents in the normal physiological patient, so to speak, don't last too long. But if it's a long anaesthetic and you've got some existing condition such as this, you get up the next day and you fall flat on the floor. And there's two reasons for that. One is, remember I talked about those reflexes that maintain your ability to maintain vascular tone, all sort of thing, they're already compromised in yourselves already. And then you've got the drugs on top of that, that we've given to you, okay, which are lasting longer than they do in the average patient. Then if you've had pain, the nurses have given you something as well, and you may have had something to put you to sleep a little bit as well at night. So the next day, you're way behind the average sort of person in your ability to compensate. So you stand up, and this is not uncommon just for ordinary patients, stand up and they go straight to the floor. Okay? No good. No good. So particularly important in your situation where you have some sort of disorder.
Is it Trudy?
Yes.
She was saying that happened to her.
Yeah. This is quite some years ago. Not that this had been identified then, what I feel I had. But I just thought it was an after effect.
The other thing is the blood pressure after the operation will tend, unless you suffer hypertension as well, that is high blood pressure as a separate entity, generally tends to be lower. So if a little bit of blood loss in patients with your syndrome and some of these other syndromes creates quite a drop in blood pressure because you just don't have the compensatory mechanisms to vasoconstrict like that, like others do.
My question then was around fainting. It's been a very common thing for me all my life. When there is something to react to, then I'll commonly faint. In particular, if I'm having a gastroenteritis attack, I will faint, and my husband gets very, very worried because he was going to call the ambulance. But to me, it's normal.
Is that with vomiting?
Beforehand.
The nausea?
I will feel as though I'm going to faint before anything happens.
Mm.
And I know to get onto the floor. And I'll go out, and my husband will get really worried. But I tell him it's okay. And I can hear the singing in the bells and so on and so forth. And I hear him talking to me, but I can't move. And eventually I come around. It may only, I don't know how long it takes, because we don't time it. It might only be half a minute, I don't know, half a minute. And then I will start to rearrange myself and get ill. I'll try to get any more graphic detail. As a child, I understand I fainted a lot. And this was after I had had polio. But I don't understand the mechanism, and I suspect it's something to do with the brain stem.
Yeah.
And how that mechanism works, and therefore how it will go with anaesthetic as well.
When you, for example, when you're trying to vomit, this is a bit more long, when you try to vomit, you can feel your stomach. Okay, now that pushes, then there's a change in the dynamics of blood flow. So that, in effect, you've got less blood to the brain in the normal individual. And then you've got the parasympathetic system, the vagus nerve, which is also activated. It's part of the mechanism. And that tends to slow down heart rate. So classically, in a normal vomiting, there's a change in pressures, less flow to the brain, the heart will tend to slow down, it's also compressed, and people can faint. just, my wife does that. Every time she vomits, she faints on the floor. And she goes blue. And that's an excessive sort of response. But that's what it is. It is, and it's through the brainstem.
It's not necessarily polio doing that.
It certainly wouldn't help it, because polio virus will tends to affect any of the nerves with outgoing signals.
Yes.
And there are outgoing signals down the vagus there. Yeah. So it could well be. Yeah.
Does that relate to anaesthetic?
Yes, it does. Means you're more likely to have low blood pressure after surgery, you tolerate less blood loss, and certainly in recovery, in the first few days, you're more likely to faint. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
And then they give you drugs on top of that.
Are you of the opinion that people who have had polio really should not have an operation unless it's really dire, because the anaesthetic is not good for them? Because when you have polio, your heart muscles are damaged.
No.
Because Murray was going to have an operation a few years ago,
yeah.
And he got all prepped, ready to go to the theatre,
yeah.
And then the surgeon came down and he said, well, we prefer not to do an operation on you because you have had polio, and it is not good for people who have had polio to have an operation?
No, I'm not quite black and white as that.
Like,
yeah, no, it depends on the operation, first of all. For example, we'll say hip replacement, that's common in your age group, hip replacements and knee replacements. The pain can be so bad in hip, you know, people before they have the operation, that they are desperate to have the operation. And they've got the choice, either going on in terrible pain or having the operation. Now, we can give you an anaesthetic with your polio to have that done. We can do it. There is the additional risks, as we've been through today. There are the additional risks. Yeah, so it's a matter of balancing that risk out. I know patients who, in this case, their hearts have been so terrible that everybody said no. And the patients pled and begged for the operation. And they say, yep, I'll do the anaesthetic, but the risks are high. How high? We can't put a number on it, really. We can take 100 people like you, and I can tell you the chances are 30% will have a heart attack, okay?
Yeah.
But if you have the heart attack, it's 1 in 1.
Yeah.
Okay? So the risks, if you talk about percentage, is a little bit meaningless, because if it happens to you, it's 1 in 1. There's no such thing as percentages.
Yeah.
So I said to the patients, there's quite a few, if you're prepared to take the risk, we do it.
Yeah.
And we have done them. And most of them have done well. We've lost one.
Yeah.
So just if you know the risks, we'll do it. And the anaesthetics today are better than they were even 5 years ago with the newer agents. We've had newer agents, newer techniques, better understanding, better measurements, better monitoring. It's all improved in even the last 5 years, particularly since ether, we've really improved. Ether was a very good agent, very good. We'd like to have ether back if it didn't smell so bad and it didn't make you vomit. Excellent otherwise.
Bruce, I think Bev wanted to tell your experience with your teeth, did you? Is that one thing I wouldn't like you to miss out on hearing about?
Anaesthetics, yes, I react badly, but I was probably only 10 years ago that I realised that it was polio, and I should have been saying to them, you know, probably half of what you're giving to anybody else. I went in to have a crown done a few years back and had the anaesthetic, and like you said, it wasn't just the top, it was the whole of my head down my throat. It was 5 hours. I couldn't control my lips, wasn't breathing properly, couldn't have eaten or tried to swallow. It was just really horrible. So the next time I went back, I said, I don't know about having the other one done. And he said, I'll give you half. It looks 2.5 hours. So now we've got it sussed. I have a quarter of what you could see anybody else. And it still takes about an hour, but it allows me to have pain-free dentistry and still recover in a reasonable time.
So is it really important then? I haven't found a dentist yet, but I need to tell them that I'm post-polio.
With local anaesthetic, there's a tremendous range of variability even within the normal population. So it's very difficult to get that right first time round, because I don't know where you are. You know the normal population distribution curve goes like that. You've probably seen those bell-shaped curves. Well, it's really wide like that. So I don't know if you're here or here. And then, of course, you've got the polio on it, so heavens knows where you are on that spectrum.
The question I was wondering, does it matter where you've had polio? Because some of us here have had mostly, some of us have had upper respiratory, you know, the upper half of us, some of us had bottom half. And was you, is yours more?
Mine was my leg and my left side.
And Dick, your polio was everywhere but upper?
All over there.
Yeah. So does that make a difference, do you think?
I don't think it does. Not when it comes to these autonomic things we're talking about and distributions and pharmacological responses. I don't think it does.
Okay,
I
just...
I think it would be if your breathing was affected, wouldn't it?
Oh, yeah. The other thing is if you're paralysed in your legs, for example, we might think twice about doing a spinal anaesthetic or anything to do with your back. Mm-hmm. We might think twice, unless there's overriding other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for example, supposing you had a hip replacement... Sorry, what's your name?
Barbara.
Barbara. Suppose you have a hip replacement. For the first hip replacement, we do most, but we do another spinal anaesthetic.
Yeah.
Okay, there's all sorts of reasons for that. But we may think twice in your case because of your paralysis of your legs. So we might consider a general anaesthetic. If we did that, that's fine. Then we would make allowance for post-operative care that may be specifically designed for you. And we often do that now. We'll have a specific pathway for specific patients. And usually... I organise that if I'm the anaesthetist. So I say, this patient's going to HDU, this is what's going to happen in HDU, and then if that doesn't work, they're going to intensive care, and I ring up and make sure there's a bed there. If there's no bed, it doesn't happen. So that's what we do. So in your case, and a lot of your case, you'd have to have a special pathway planned for you, and that we need your patient advocate talking about earlier, and that tends to be the anaesthetist for the immediate period. But once you get into the wards, we lose you.
Yeah.
And you just become...
And that's another situation, you see.
Pain control, once you've had the operation come out, I find that very often the pain relief they give me doesn't work very well. But if they give me a heavier dose for a shorter period of time, it usually knocks it to where I can hold the pain off. Because I'm 6'2½", and they look at me and think, oh, yeah, it's a little lady, I'm not.
Mm.
And quite often, the amount that they give you,
that's where you'd have to tell them, because I would say, you know, you're 6 foot?
6 foot two.
Yeah, so your, what we call your volume of distribution for the drug would probably be reasonably big, okay? So therefore you need a bigger dose. But at the same time, the effect of the polio might change that either way. You may, because quite a few I think it's about 20-30% of post-polio sufferers do have this, what we call wind-up, which is where the whole analgesia system has become more sensitive. Now, you may be one of those, you may not, I don't know. And maybe you can tell me, maybe you say, no, I'm not, but I don't really know. So there's all these factors. I don't know where you are on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
But you do know now, you know where you are.
But
so,
I mean, how do you convince people that? Because they give you a normal amount for a normal person, but they want to say you're stupid, it's working. You just don't know it. They get so angry because they don't listen.
Post-operative pain relief is a really difficult area when you're not the normal person. Even when the normal person is difficult, but when you're not the normal person physiologically, it becomes increasingly tricky. And there's a lot of judgment involved on part of whoever's doing the administration of the narcotic or whatever they're giving to you. Not an easy one to answer, and an unsatisfactory situation.
An epidural when you're having a baby and your legs are paralysed, did you say that was dangerous or wrong?
Do I say?
An epidural, when you have paralysed legs, you're having a baby.
Oh, like you post-polio, you mean? Or?
Yes.
I would think twice about touching anything on the back in a patient who has post-polio, particularly
the
legs.
I had an epidural when I had my baby, and I had those legs.
Yeah, okay.
But I also had a cracked hip, and since then I've got pins and a big piece.
And yeah, did it with the spinal?
Surgery, I've got work at a hospital, putting those in.
With the spinal?
Pardon?
With the spinal? Yeah. The spinal, yeah.
Yeah.
I'll be spinal, probably. Yep.
And my next one, I've got to have a carotid artery done. And I'm not going to do it with I actually had it, went in to have it done through my groin. And they found out that I couldn't do it that way because it was blocked on the curve at the top. Put a stent in.
Yep.
So they said they'd leave it for later. And I went back and had another scan, and they said it was about 79% blocked, and it would need to be done. And they yet they can do it with a local anaesthetic.
Yeah, that's right.
Then I told them that I had to avoid anaesthetics.
No, you can do it with a local anaesthetic,
yeah,
and you don't
no,
need.
I've
yeah,
two people that
yeah,
done
yeah,
that.
Yeah. Dave Farrar does it mainly that way. There's three vascular surgeons: Dave Farrar, Ross Blair. What's another one? Oh, is it Vasu. And Dave Farrar does Mundaloka. He's done all that. He does all these that way.
Yeah, I know two people that have.
It's hard work for the anaesthetist because there's this thing at Bama where you squeeze to make sure you're okay. You've got to squeeze this thing because if they operate on this side and that side of the brain's affected, then you could be able to squeeze your hand. So it's quite interesting, actually. It's Mundaloka because we used to do, and we still do.
I've got to be able to squeeze my hand.
Yeah, you do. Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk to you. We'll talk to you. But we do a lot of neurosurgery under local now too. A lot of it's done with patients awake, even on the brain.
Are we able to request you when we go to hospital?
I only work there on Tuesdays.
Oh, make sure we go on Tuesdays.
Not if everybody goes at the same
time.
No, I think it's an opportune time to. It sounds as though you need to get the dentist along here too. Because more of you probably see dentists. You're seeing dentists more than anybody else. So I reckon you ought to get dentists along and get it spread amongst the dental community as well. But certainly approaching the hospital, apart from carrying your own cards and things, having something on the intranet and making the...
I like the idea of following through on that.
We also have little anaesthetic alert systems too that we put... If I had somebody come through, they'd get an alert system put on there.
Brucey, do you have any prestige in the hospital that you're able to sort of push anything like?
Well, anaesthetic-wise, I do.
Yeah.
I could certainly get the anaesthetic department
too. Do you
do
any training? Do you do any tutoring or anything like
that? Not these days, I don't. I've grown out of that.
Yeah.
But my junior registrars are trained, now they're bosses. So.
Yeah. Sorry. I'm just wondering how the word can, just watch out for those polio patients when they come.
Yeah, I can start that off from our end.
Yeah,
from
I just don't know how that would
I asked a nurse about that and she said that they got half an hour.
And then you get those spinal cord injuries, they get half an hour of lecture.
That's pretty good, really.
I was in the corporate office and I have in mind starting off there. They would be the people probably who would start getting a policy together.
Jen Adams would be the place to start. Jen Adams. That'd be a place to start.
Well,
she's the manager of the hospital. She's clinical manager. Yeah.
Well, what can we say, except we could have gone on for several hours on the subject. And I don't know whether we're any easier or more peaceful in our mind about the future of any hospital procedures we may or may not need. But certainly been good to hear from Bruce, hasn't it?
Yes.
It's been great. Yes. And we thank you for giving up your lovely sunny afternoon with...
Excellent.
It's very hard to explain anything to doctors.
But even having somebody like you who we've had your ear and you've been able to speak to us about the situation has been very, very good to us because we just don't feel we have the ear of too many people. A bit like a voice crying in the wilderness in a way, isn't it?
Yes.
And that's why we need the support group like this so we can encourage and uplift each other through some of the things we face. But thank you for coming today, Bruce. We really appreciate
it. It's okay.
Your
thank you for educating me.